Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, especially those who have decided that there are other things in life besides football and hanging out at sports bar. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And today, for the full hour, we decided with Hu Jintao and D.C. for the week and China in the air, there was no better time to bring the China back to Midrats. And today we have the authors of a new book out of the Naval Institute Press, Red Star Over the Pacific, China's Rise and the Challenge to U.S. Maritime Security. We have Toshi Yoshihara and James Holmes as our guests. They are both associate professors over at the Naval War College in sunny Newport. And just as a reminder for those that are joining us live, if you could, we have the show page, and at the bottom you're going to find the chat room. And at the chat room you're going to find our usual suspects. So fold in with them. If you have some observations and some comments you'd like to make about the show as we go on, or if there's a question that you would like for us to approach our guests with, please hop in. We'll both be up on the chat room. We'll try to fold that in as soon as possible. And always, I want to extend an invitation to those who are new to Midrats or have only caught a couple of our shows. You can get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes. So let's get on with the show. Toshi and Jim, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks.
Thanks.
I wanted to start off, first of all, wanted to congratulate both of you on your book, and this is the reason why. A lot of the recent books coming out on China, they can be a little heavy, they can be a little dense, and some of it is just a conglomeration of various other items. But in your book, Red Star Over the Pacific, it's a real tight 224 pages. Very approachable. So congratulations on being able to get the world's largest country into 224 pages.
Thanks. I think we have a real shortage of books about that size these days. If you look back at a lot of the classics in international relations, which is what Toshi and I specialize in, a lot of the great works like Diplomacy by Harold Nicholson are 100, 150 pages long, and they managed to compress a whole lot of content into just a few pages. So I hope we did as well.
Well, what are you trying to, with this book, what are you trying to put together, and what would you really want the reader to focus on?
Well, I think one of the key points, one of our key purposes for the volume is to try to convey the idea that China's rise as a sea power is not going to be a temporary phenomenon, but rather it's going to be a sustained challenge to U.S. maritime strategy in Asia, because the Chinese are growing along multiple vectors, both in terms of their intellectual capacity to think about the seas, their material capabilities, but also in terms of their grand strategy, in terms of their diplomatic strategies in East Asia, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia. So this is going to be, I think, a sustained growth of the Chinese. It's not going to be something that will end anytime soon. And we hope that this book makes that point very clear, that this challenge, although subtle in certain aspects, it is here to stay.
In your recent article in Naval Institute Proceedings about China, and your suggestion that there might be a turn to Corbett, Julian Corbett, being a naval strategist along with Alfred Mahan, or Mahan, depending on where you're from, could you discuss, just shortly, kind of give the listeners a brief introduction to Mahan and to Corbett, and discuss where China is going with that and how that fits into the strategic picture as you all see it?
Jim, why don't you take that?
And you have 30 seconds, Dan.
Oh, in 30 seconds. Well, okay. Yeah, Mahan in 30 seconds.
I'm just.
Yeah, well, you know, Mahan's, if you ever look at Mahan's bibliography done by John Hattendorf, our historian at the college, just his bibliography is well over 100 pages, so reducing him to 30 seconds is not easy. We've advanced the argument over the last few years that, and we look to another one of our deities at the Naval War College, Carl von Clausewitz, who proposes that that essentially there's a logic and then there's a grammar of strategy in politics, the logic furnishing the very high level sort of the ethereal guidance for strategy, and then obviously the grammar being the stuff that we're used to thinking about, force structure and doctrine and all that sort of thing. What we've argued is that that China tends to look at Mahan, and they talk about Mahan all the time, but they look at him for the logic, for the very high-level guidance into what navies are for. Why do we need sea power? Mahan proposes that commerce is king. This is really what drives sea power. The three elements of sea power are commerce, implying domestic production, and also naval and merchant shipping, and then bases, overseas naval stations of some sort to support the operations of fleets. And I think they've really internalized that. What we've tried to start getting into with the China and Corbett piece in the Naval Institute proceedings that you mentioned is, we've been expecting for some time for the Chinese to start widening their view of Mahan, and to start looking at other theorists and to start trying to weave them into an overall Chinese theory of sea power. They started off with Mahan. We started looking at this back in 2004. They pretty much started off with Mahan's definition of command of the sea, which is very bloody-minded, overbearing power that drives an enemy's flag from vital waters, or at most allows it to appear as a fugitive. That was pretty much the sum total of Chinese understanding of Mahan in those days. But they've started reading more widely. They've read more of his works, and they're factoring that into their strategic thought now. And they're starting to look at other theorists like Corbett. To us, if you ever read Corbett, he functions mostly down on the grammatical level, using the Clausewitzian construct I put out a minute ago. And he talks about active defense. He talks about using fleets very very offensively, even in pursuit of defensive aims. This, to me, if you took Corbett's name off his book and you read it not knowing who the author was, you might actually think it was a Chinese scholar at times, because it almost sounds like Mao's notion of active defense, which he obviously fashioned for land warfare, but then the Chinese are now applying that to the sea. So it just seemed like Corbett was a natural fit for the Chinese, and so we weren't surprised to see them start turning to Corbett, but we did want to get the word out as they start doing this.
You, Jim, maybe this is one of your areas of specialty, India. Maybe this would be something to toss into your lap. But as China grows, whether you're looking at it from an economic point of view or just because of their sheer size, when people are comparing the growth of China, you know, pretty soon the conversation comes towards the growth of India, especially since they've started to move away from Fabian socialism, and you're seeing some improvement on their growth rates. And one thing that kind of sticks out about India is when you look at the various places that China is reaching out to in order to get access to the resources and the raw material in order to maintain their economy and to keep producing things at the below market prices, get jobs for their people, etc. It's through the Indian Ocean. So obviously that concern and that focus on India, you not only have that land border, but you also have that sea border. How do the Indians view China's rise in some ways different than the Americans are?
We actually appreciate you steering in that direction, because Toshi and I and another colleague we've actually written a book a few years ago, or I guess it was 2-3 years ago now, on the Indian Navy and the rise of India. And obviously, as you hinted at, a huge part of that is is geared to China, to what China's naval ambitions might be in the Indian Ocean. It feels a little bit strange. India is a little, obviously is a big democracy, but very unruling. There are different factions saying all different things at any given time. The Navy, the Indian Navy, seems, for obvious reasons, very tunnel visioned on the Chinese threat. I'd just offer one small example that makes up a lot of the discourse on China in the Indian Ocean: the notion of a string of pearls. This was a notion that came out of a Booz Allen study about 5 years ago. But basically, the notion that China had embarked on a quest for a Mahanian base network. Remember, that's one of the elements of Mahanian sea power. Basically, looking for these forward naval stations in the Indian Ocean. This term "string of pearls" comes out of the United States, is immediately seized on by the Indians, and pretty much taken as gospel. Even today, a lot of the naval commentators and the military commentators will say as fact that China is doing this. It is looking for bases like comparable to our own base network in the Western Pacific and Hawaii and so forth. And that's obviously a troubling thing for the Navy, which has to worry about Indian maritime security. India, strangely, Toshi and I have found that, I studied things like the Monroe Doctrine and Mahan and stuff like that when I was in graduate school, just because I was interested in it. But these are things that these rising sea powers are reading a lot. India sees itself as number one in the Indian Ocean, and Indian leaders will explicitly cite the Monroe Doctrine as a precedent for Indian foreign policy. So if you think about how the United States looked at European powers in the Western Hemisphere 100 years ago, transpose that to the Indian Ocean today, that gives you some sense of how Indians think about encroachment of powers like China in their own backyard. So clearly within naval circles and military circles, China is job number one. When you move up into the political realm, obviously that you're going to get a lot of different viewpoints. But clearly within the Indian Armed Forces, China is number one. Hey, Toshi, you want to add to that? Did I skip anything
sure.
important?
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that there is sort of mutual suspicion that's animating Sino-Indian relations. Just as some Indians tend to interpret the worst of intentions from the Chinese think the same way about the Indians. They are convinced that the Indians do in fact have blue water ambitions and that they intend to extend their naval reach in concentric rings well into China's own backyard, particularly in the South China Sea. And there are many Chinese commentators who argue that New Delhi's look east policy, which is more of a broader political economic strategy in East Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, they not only see that as a political economic strategy, but they also interpret it as a military strategy designed to tie down the Chinese. Some commentators, for example, say that part of India's look east policy is specifically to develop strategic relations with Vietnam. That would then serve to sort of force the Chinese to concentrate its attention in Southeast Asia, and particularly in the South China Sea, so that it will not have the energy to look farther west into the Indian Ocean. So I think there's a very interesting dynamic here where both sides, I think, look at each other very warily. And I think this is going to be part of the ingredients that's going to fuel this very sort of quiet competition in the maritime domain.
Yeah, although a lot of Chinese maritime thinkers do take a rather dismissive view of the Indian, not only of the Indian comprehensive national power, economic growth, and this and whatnot, but also specifically of the Indian Navy. It does seem that China does feel a little bit conflicted about India. On the very high level, they understand that India is a country on the move and it has grand ambitions, but they simply doubt that India will be able to follow through on it in material terms anytime soon.
Right, and I think what's interesting about that is that there's sort of a hierarchy of condescension in maritime relations. The way the Chinese speak about Indian
sure.
naval power is almost very similar to the way the United States looked at Chinese naval power about 10 years ago, when people talked about China's coercive option against Taiwan as being a million-man swim. That type of condescension, I think, still characterizes some of Chinese commentary about Indian material capabilities at sea. But I think it is also worth observing, perhaps down the road, that there might be an inflection point where the Chinese begin to reassess Indian naval power, just as Americans have recently begun to reassess Chinese naval power in the Western Pacific.
Right.
Eagle One?
Well, let me shift the focus for a second to a different part of Asia. I was listening to an interview with Dr. Henry Kissinger that somebody in the Wall Street Journal did, and they asked him what the major concerns in our relationship with China would be. And much to my surprise, rather than mentioning Taiwan, he went first to North Korea. Can you guys... Do you have a feel for that? How does that fit into this, and where does Chinese naval power fit into that sort of situation?
Well, I think there tends to be sort of, you know, myopia about the cross-strait relationship. You know, I think a lot of the commentary tends to surround the most recent trends and the most recent events that dictate cross-strait relations, but I think that we've seen pendulum swings to more crisis-prone situations and then to more stable situations. So just because things have gotten, you know, towards more stability in the past 2 years does not mean that that relationship will, in fact, shift back to a more crisis-prone situation. And I think one of the wild cards here is Taiwan's politics. You know, that's something that neither the United States nor China can control. So I think there's no way of knowing how the elections in Taiwan in 2012 will turn out to be. And if that's the case, if the Taiwanese elect a leader that the Chinese consider to be unfavorable to Chinese policy, I think it's very possible that we could swing back to the kind of language that we saw from the Chinese in 2000, where you could get a sense that the Chinese leadership did not feel that time was on its side and therefore was prepared to pressure the Taiwanese to try to resolve their disputes. And so I think even though things look good now, I would not foreclose the possibility that things could in fact go badly in the coming years. And in that sense, I think that the Chinese are continuing to build up their deterrent force across the island as a strategic hedge against that potential eventuality or possibility. And so, again, I wouldn't write off the Taiwan situation as something that will be, secure on an indefinite basis.
Yeah, one of our very first essays that we did together, and I think it was in the Naval War College Review in the 2005 timeframe, we had some fun with it. We went back and looked at the Peloponnesian War, the Great War between Athens and Sparta 2,500 years ago, which involved island warfare. And we essentially said that China's not building up all this weaponry opposite Taiwan in order to use it. It's trying to build up such a lopsided advantage in power that it simply forecloses all of the Taiwanese options. The piece or the little historical tidbit we used was the famous Melian dialogue of Thucydides, in which the Athenians essentially demanded that a city state, Melos, a city state in the Aegean, submit to Athens, and they say one of the greatest lines in there is the Athenian ambassadors say the strong do it as they will and the weak do as they must, the point being that too strong an asymmetry of power does away with questions of justice and all these other political questions that Taiwan would like to see answered before it comes back to some sort of reunion with the mainland. So yeah, I think that Taiwan is it's off the headlines certainly since the election of President Ma back in 2008. Everybody has declared that the cross-strait situation is on the upswing. I actually don't think that's the case at all.
Kind of shifting a little bit again, in many ways we can go back to the discussion about Mahan, but as people try to look forward for China and the directions China is going towards, they naturally will look back as well. A lot of people will look at China's growing navy and will try to compare that to the growth of either the Japanese Navy, the Royal Navy, or when America grew as a military power. But a lot of discussions, and one thing that y'all do bring up in your book, is perhaps a better nation to look at would be the decisions and the reasoning behind post-unification Germany and their naval power and their strategy and how they tried to not so much counter Britain, but perhaps find different ways to addressing Sea Power and its impact on their growth and their trade. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Jim, why don't you go ahead and take a
look at that one? Yeah, sure. Obviously, one of the historical markers when people discuss the rise of China today is Imperial Germany. This the emergence all of a sudden of this big strong power in the midst of Europe, where the concert of Europe after that was fashioned after Napoleon's fall. It pretty much depended on the existence of a number of relatively equal powers. All of a sudden, you had this this big Germany that might throw its way around and really wreck the system. The Chinese have studied themselves have studied this episode in great detail. Published a series of books on the rise of past great powers, including Germany. You can look at Otto von Bismarck's Germany, the early years of the German Empire, as being a self-restraining power, a power that that went out of its way not to be too aggressive and too frightening to its neighbors. But Bismarck in 1890 is fired by Kaiser Wilhelm II after his father dies, and he launches, and we know how this all comes out. Kaiser Wilhelm II goes out of his way to seemingly antagonize his neighbors and ultimately marches Europe over the cliff. But a lot of times the comparisons pretty much stop there. So about 18 months ago, we got the idea that, well, why don't we look at what this would have meant at sea? Is China similar to Germany as far as its looking to the sea and building a navy and all of this sort of thing? So we, in one of the chapters in the book and in an article that we did before that, we essentially took a geographic look at the North Sea, compared it to the China Seas, and just played with it and tried to see whether China would be more formidable than Germany, less formidable, or about the same. We ended up concluding that that China will most likely be display a lot more staying power. It has a lot better access to the high seas, even though it has to confront the offshore island chains and so forth. For example, if you look at the map of the North Sea, Germany pretty much only has two outlets to the sea. It's either got to run through the English Channel, or it's got to shoot through the gap between Norway and Scotland. This was fairly easy for the Royal Navy to seal off. Germany really didn't have that many options, especially given the fact that it had a navy that was short range and had very little chance of going out and seizing assets like the Orkney Islands and this sort of thing. So again, we play with it. We ultimately come down maintaining that Germany is going to be a far more formidable competitor for the U.S. and its neighbors than Germany ever was for Great Britain. Did I pretty much say that right, Toshi?
Yeah. I think what's very interesting is that, as you read the Chinese literature about how they read the history and what lessons they learn from the rise of previous great powers, I think their study of the rise of Imperial Germany is a particularly interesting one. They hold Bismarck as sort of their model, somebody who's able to engage in deft diplomacy to prevent balancing behavior among Germany's potential adversaries. And yet what is interesting is that they selectively overlook the fact that it was under Bismarck that Prussia engaged in three wars of unification to create a larger unified German state. And this is something that they very easily gloss over, as if that's not the important part. The part is how Bismarck acted like a statesman, but they overlook the fact that Germany had to go through several bloody wars in order to reach that particular status. And so I think it's very interesting how the Chinese have been very selective in their view of history and the kinds of lessons that they want to draw rather than the lessons that they should draw. And I think that's one of the things that we ought to be tracking in terms of the kinds of lessons learned that they have gotten from their view of European history.
Let's talk a little bit about the aircraft carrier killing missile and that the Chinese seem to have developed. And I know Admiral Holloway responded to your article with an article of a piece of his own, arguing that we need big deck carriers even more than ever. How much of this has to do with whether China is going to be a regional power or a true international power, and where do you guys see them going? I mean, right now your book limits it to the Pacific, but are they interested in more than that?
I think to take a small point you raised, Admiral Holloway was actually, I think he was actually responding to Andrew Erickson's piece on the ASMA being a game changer, the anti-ship ballistic missile basically putting carriers into flames and this sort of thing. I guess we were among that, but he had those guys in mind. Yeah, we do.
Well, I didn't mean to tar you with painting.
I read the article and I said I actually did a double take and wondered if he was aiming that at us, but I think it was actually Andrew. Andrew Erickson's been all over the. I guess he's probably been the leading commentator on that. For the purposes of the book, we did limit it to the Pacific just because that's sort of where we were at the time when the time came to publish the book. Since then, we've started moving on in a lot of areas, not only this Corbett thing, but also geographically, looking at China in the Indian Ocean. I've advanced the notion in an article that's about to appear that China is on the verge, if this anti-ship ballistic missile lives up to its hype, of making a concept that's never worked before work, namely the concept of a fortress fleet. And I picked that up from Mahan. Mahan commented on the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905. He was brutally critical of the Russian fleet at Port Arthur for keeping the fleet underneath the cover of the fort's guns. He said this was a radically erroneous approach to naval warfare, not only because it circumscribed the radius of action for the fleet, but also because it instilled defensive mindedness in skippers and essentially left the Russian fleet prey for Admiral Togo's fleet. But if you look back at the situation in those days, what were the range of the guns? Probably 10 miles at most. So if you swing a 10-mile circle around Port Arthur, that's a pretty small operating area for the fleet. But if you update that, if we suppose that shore-based gunnery, in quotation marks, shore-based missiles can now extend fire support all the way, hundreds of miles offshore, that starts looking like a very effective umbrella for fleet operations pretty much throughout Asia. If anyone wants to look at this, you can go to any of the China military power reports put out by the Pentagon each year. Look at the map of Asia that traces the missile arcs all the way around the Chinese coast. If you look at that yellow sort of that yellow crosshatched arc, that's the anti-ship ballistic missiles arc, which would allow the Chinese second artillery to cover not only all of East Asia, but the entire South China Sea, Strait of Malacca, the Bay of Bengal, and even part of the Arabian Sea. If you station ASVMs in Western China, Tibet or Xinjiang or what have you. So we see that as part of the common denominator to China's approach to all the seas around its periphery and to the Indian Ocean. This is a way for China to get to impose some virtual presence and extend some support to its fleet, even very far from Chinese shores.
Just a few words on the ASBM. In our book, we basically used the opportunity to put in a critique, I think, of the way the China watching community assesses China. I think a lot of the buzz around the ASBM was in terms of technical feasibility, and I think a lot of American analysts look back to the Soviet experience and basically made the argument that because the Soviets couldn't do it or ended up choosing not to do it, that the same fate would befall the Chinese. We make the argument that because the Chinese look at the seas and look at their strategic priorities very differently, that they might see value in the ASBM regardless of technical feasibility for their own local purposes. And so I think that there tends to be a lot of mirror imaging that goes around that says that if we don't think it's a rational thing to do, or if another Western power did not think that it was a rational thing to do, then the Chinese probably either wouldn't do it or fail to do it. So I think we make a pretty strong argument, I think, that the Chinese will make those decisions based on their own assessments about their local conditions. And even if the ASVM does not work as advertised or is not the game changer that they hope that it might be, it adds an additional tool in their toolbox to try to deter U.S. Behavior in the Western Pacific to make it increasingly more costly for U.S. intervention in China's own maritime backyard.
I absolutely agree with that last point. It's one I've brought up on a couple of occasions, is the modern version of, I guess, the fortress fleet. And what I see in the anti-ship ballistic missile technology and a few other items is there are two ways you can work a Navy. And in my little verbal shorthand, you can have your power projection fleet, or you can have a porcupine strategy. When you look at the buildup opposite Taiwan that you mentioned earlier, but you also look at this anti-access, anti-denial, reaching out to the first island chain, the second island chain, where it appears when you take that with their new fleet of fast missile attack boats and a lot of their other technology, where if you're going to come across an ocean to interfere with China from the sea, they're creating an environment where it's just the cost to do that and the risk that you take makes it so painful to get close enough to their initial areas of highest concern in the waters that it's just not worth the risk to get involved. And once they establish that, then I think you're also seeing, as they're tenderly looking at how do we potentially have some type of carrier-based aviation and what do we do with that, that once the porcupine is well established and they learn a lot from there, then we're going to see from behind the porcupine spines more of a power projection as we see it, and that it's not helpful to look at, you know, is China more of a Germany or is China more of a Soviet, but China has some very Chinese characteristics to it that we might be looking at something a little bit different than that. Do you see things developing along those lines, or perhaps something else?
Yeah, I mean,
I think so.
Go ahead, Jim.
How about it?
Well, I think the way the Chinese talk about their geographic, their maritime geographic environment, I think is a key to understanding how the Chinese might conceive of their naval operations and how they would try to project power. And I think the one way of looking at it is how the Chinese describe their maritime environment. Admiral Liu Huaqing, who passed away very recently at the age of 95, he's often dubbed the founder of the Chinese modern Navy, had argued as early as the 1980s about developing a near-sea strategy. And the near-sea refers to those bodies of water that are roughly encompassed by the first island chain. That's the Yellow Sea, East China Sea, and South China Sea. And it's not surprising that in the past 18 months, those are the places that we're beginning to see greater and greater friction as Chinese naval power rises. And I think the way the Chinese describe the near seas connotes a very proprietary view of those bodies of water. China has had a very long interaction with its neighbors across these three seas, and it sees that essentially as an inner belt of its own waters. And so I think they have a much more proprietary views of those three seas, of the near seas, and that they're going to try to assert greater influence within those bodies of water as their sort of sequential strategy of perhaps reaching out beyond the first island chain. But I think their primary focus at the moment is to be able to protect their maritime interest, whether it's strategic or economic, within the first island chain. And I think this near-sea strategy, I think, is going to remain a central pillar of Chinese naval strategy. And I think there's a danger of being distracted by all this talk about the far sea strategy. I think that they are still very far, I think, from being able to achieve some of their aims that's embedded in the far sea strategy, because they still have got a lot of business to resolve within the near seas. And I think the ASVIM, you know, I think fits into that structure, which is, as you've said, to provide a protective shield over waters that it believes are important, and to be able to project limited naval power, at least the way, as we conceive of it, limited naval power within that envelope, where they can then be able to coerce or to engage in gunboat diplomacy or to engage in naval diplomacy at will.
Yeah, Toshi and I teach an elective at the college on Chinese sea power, and we just had the lesson on the, what I called it, the future fleet. Basically, the way I saw it shaping up, this is the way I put it to them. I said, well, if you look at the Chinese Navy, you look at the forces that they have or they're procuring and so forth, well, it looks like almost a three-tiered force. One of those tiers isn't there yet, namely the global fleet that we're familiar with from our own experience. But clearly they've stayed true to their Maoist background as far as acquiring some of the things you mentioned, Hobei, fast patrol boats, with stealthy missile armed and so forth. So there's a sea denial fleet, and then there's a fortress fleet that can operate under cover of this anti-ship ballistic missile, assuming that thing again pans out. One point I like to make about the fortress fleet is simply that if the anti-ship ballistic missile can indeed deter our own Navy from entering the Western Pacific, that eases a lot of the burden on Chinese shipbuilders to come up with platforms equal to our own. The carrier project, that's something that's occasioned a lot of discussion in the last few weeks. If the Chinese don't have to build against CVNs such as those that we have in our own Navy, then they could make do with something far less, certainly until they get good at carrier operations and flight operations and so forth.
Yeah, I always thought it was a way to, when some people, you know, you talk about a little bit overheated concern or discussions about when Chinese does something, that it's often useful to consider what our reactions would be towards operations in the Gulf of Mexico or in the waters between Hawaii and California by another naval power, one that may be doing things that are something beyond visiting you for Fleet Week. And if you look at the Chinese last couple of hundred years and that kind of national insecurity that they have, you can kind of understand some of their reactions in that respect. But when it comes to this growing and expanding power in those near waters, when you look at the nations that are closest to that first and second island chain or even inside of them, most notably our close allies, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and even nations that we're getting along with better and better and have some shared priorities, the Vietnamese, in their literature, are they looking at this the same way we are, or are they perhaps looking at it from a different angle that could enlighten the discussion here in the U.S.?
Well, I think that certainly the Japanese find themselves in sort of the crosshairs of this anti-access area denial strategy. The Chinese like to comment that the Japanese occupy the northern anchor of the first island chain, including the Ryukyu Islands, and I think that a string of islands essentially is a very real physical barrier in some Chinese mind to their maritime ambitions, that this island chain serves as a sort of a maritime straitjacket that's designed to hem in China's capacity to project power beyond the first island chain. And so the Chinese view the U.S.-Japan alliance in particular as a major obstacle to their aspirations at sea. And I think that the Japanese, in turn, are taking Chinese actions in the near seas very, very seriously. There's a map in the most recent defense white paper that highlights all of China's major naval activities that essentially cuts across the first island chain through Japanese waters, essentially, through the Miyako Strait, for example, in the Ryukyus, and a couple of years ago through the Tsugaru Strait. One official in Tokyo reportedly told an American scholar that when he looks at these maps tracing Chinese naval activities, it looks like ramen noodles pouring through the first island chain. So I think there's clearly China's increasing interest in asserting its will within the near seas is having an interactive effect on Japan. And I think that's what explains why the Japanese, in their recent reposturing of their defense policy for the next decade at the very least, is thinking about shifting their strategic posture from the north increasingly to the southwest to defend those offshore islands along the Ryukyus. And I think that some Japanese do indeed think that they will essentially be the first line of defense. One admiral talked about how it's not just the U.S. carrier that might be at risk from the Chinese ASBIM, it might be the Japanese flat tops, their helicopter destroyers, that would be also be a lucrative target for the Chinese. And so I think that we need to be much more active, I think, in reassuring our allies, in particular Japan, as it becomes increasingly falls within the envelope of China's missiles and other power projection capabilities.
Yeah, there's a lot of ferment going on in Japan. It's interesting to note that just recently, within the last few weeks, Japan has issued a new set of national defense program guidelines I guess something roughly analogous to our national defense strategy. And it's called on the GMSDF or on the self-defense forces to go from being a what they call the basic defense force or the base defense force, more of a static deterrent force to outright territorial invasion, to what they call a dynamic deterrent force, some of the forces that are able to reach those islands and repel invasion or deter military action or what have you. So clearly the Japanese are, I think they're undergoing a period of turmoil, and I think the SDF could come out looking quite different out of the far end.
Well, this is kind of a high stakes game of chicken. I mean, don't we have to trust, or we do trust to a certain extent, that the Chinese intentions are honest and open, and on the other hand, we have to maintain enough of a capability to resist that if it turns out to be otherwise, and the stakes for the neighbors, as you say, Japan, and I assume all the other friendly nations of Asia, running from Japan on down to Australia, the stakes are pretty high for them if the United States guesses wrong on what China's true intentions are. Not much
right.
of a
yeah,
question,
I,
but if you guys want to discuss it.
I was just going to, you were talking about the other nations around the Chinese periphery, that the Australians actually seem to take a rather, they don't seem all that worried, or at least not the ones we've talked to thus far. So I think the concerns tend to attenuate with a little bit with distance, but clearly in the South China Sea and places like that, and with Japan, it's a different story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this really does pose some problems. I think you actually hit on a very important point, which is the long-term investment of our allied capabilities. I mean, a lot of these very expensive high-end capabilities literally take decades to purchase and then to put into service. And I think a lot of U.S. allies are looking at some of their longer-term investment plans and saying, you know, we need to make sure that the United States is here so that we can purchase the right equipment, we will be postured in the right ways to deal with this emerging Chinese threat. And I think that that's going to influence, I think, the way they deal with China in terms of diplomacy, is that if they feel that, you know, in the worst-case scenario, if they do not believe that U.S. security commitments are either credible or real, that they may begin to take on policies that are more accommodative to China. So, again, how we deal with our allies in terms of our ability to reassure them in terms of our staying power and our commitment to the region will make a huge impact on the way that they make some decisions about what they purchase from us and what kind of defense postures that they will adopt in the coming years.
Well, to kind of follow up on that, the incident with the Victorious and the EP-3, don't those kind of send the wrong message to our allies as well as perhaps to the Chinese about what we will do in the event that they start flexing their muscles?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make an important point, is that yes, our allies are watching our every move, and I think what's the danger is that our allies tend to sometimes overread into some of our actions. One of the things that I thought was very interesting is the intense interest in the air-sea battle concept that's being debated in the Pentagon right now, and I think that there are certain elements of that concept, I think, that would trouble our allies, and so we have to be careful, I think, in terms of how we not only think about that concept, roll out that concept, but how we sort of tie in our allies into that concept as well. Because, as I've said, I think people in Tokyo and people in Canberra and elsewhere, I think, are very sensitive to every step that we take. What we consider to be, you know, a non-issue could turn out to be a very symbolic political issue for our allies. And so I think maintaining our sensitivity to our allies' views is very important. And I would also add, as an aside note, is that what I think is very interesting is that in the post-Cold War era and with the rise of China, I think that we're beginning to see a shift in scholarship as well. In the past few years, I'm having a much harder time thinking of people who are great analysts, great scholars, and great policymakers who are Japan hands. You know, much of the scholarship, much of the academic interest has in fact fled to China. So I think one of the things that we need to be doing is to continue our sort of education and training of policymakers that will be tapped into allied politics and with the security managers across the Pacific.
One thing we, Nation, we really haven't talked about much to this point that is a huge player in East Asia, and that's Russia. They're a arms supplier to China, both direct sale and something for the Chinese reverse engineer, but they're a major arms supplier to a potential Chinese competitor in India. But also, you know, you scratch a little bit under the surface, and the Chinese still hold a grudge over Russia, Far East Asia, across the Amur River. And how would you characterize the relationship between Russia and China right now? Is it more benign cooperation, or is there any type of potential friction there that might surprise us?
Well, I've always thought that the Russian arms sale relationship with the Chinese is a particularly interesting one. The way that I sort of look at it is that it's sort of in Russia's interest to sort of export their way out of their East Asia dilemma, which is that they have a huge demographic problem in the Far East. They don't have that much population sort of stability in that particular region. They know that China's a growing power and that they're going to have trouble stemming the tide of China. And they know that historically China's security obsession has been always been aimed towards the northern vector, towards the steppe of Central Asia. So I think in a way, Russia's arms sales is in a way designed to direct China's attention seaward towards the Western Pacific, to divert China's attention away from places that might harm Russia's longer-term security interests. So I think the arms sales is often pitched in terms of Russia needing hard currency, but I think there are strategic motives behind it, which is to provide the Chinese the tools with which to project power away from the Russian homeland.
Yeah, this is actually perhaps a time to return to 19th century Europe again. It's with this discussion, it always reminds me of Bismarck. We talked about Bismarck and his efforts to mollify suspicions about Germany. One way Bismarck did that was simply by encouraging the French to go overseas and become a colonial power. It feels like the Russians have much the same idea in mind with regard to China, as Soshi points out, just simply to shift the threat vector or whatever you want to call it towards the Western Pacific and away from the North.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that even the Chinese are catching on to this. I think there's in our book we talk about a debate between the sort of the neo-Mahanians in China versus the continentalists in China, and I think that the continentalists would make the argument that China's apparent obsession with sea power right now is actually playing to America's strength, because there's no way that the Chinese would be able to develop enough sea power to challenge American primacy in the Western Pacific, that essentially Beijing would be wasting its time and its resources in this maritime venture. So many of these continentalists say, look, you know, we need to continue to focus on our comparative advantage, and that is our comparative advantage on land. And I think many of them propose very interesting force structure that would be sort of more akin to our concept of air-land battle, you know, using precision strike, long-range precision strike for internal security purposes within China's far west, as well as basically protecting China's land borders, and yet having enough precision strike that could influence events at sea, at least on a limited basis. And I think they're mostly thinking about Taiwan. So I think this notion that China has a landward problem and a seaward problem is something that even the Chinese are still dealing with today, and that there really is no consensus. And this debate is ongoing between the neo-Mahanians and the continentalists.
Yeah, we should probably mention some competing views that differ with us at least somewhat. Professor Robert Ross up at Boston College has been studying the Chinese Navy for quite some years, and in fact, in the journal International Security back in 1999, he wrote a very nice article called "The Geography of the Peace in East Asia," saying exactly what Toshi just did. The United, he predicted that the U.S. would remain preeminent at sea, China would remain dominant in its own element on shore, and that neither power would really be able to get at the other one in any meaningful sense. And so he concluded that because of this whale elephant dynamic, that this an uneasy peace would ensue in East Asia.
Well, we've kind of talked strategy and stuff. Let's get down to a little more in the weeds. What one of the chat room people has asked about the quality of the PLAN and how good are their people? How good are the quality of their petty officers? Is it a growing vital force or what are we looking at?
Jim?
I'll venture. I guess, and you're not going to get too much of a straight answer out of us on this, because I think that's one of the great imponderables. Is we can look outside this maritime venture and look to a U.S. Air Force theorist, John Boyd, from back in the 1980s. He pointed out that people fight wars and not machines. He listed the key ingredients in competition as people, ideas, and hardware in that order. And the people, we have at least a rough sense of what the Chinese are doing on the material side, but as far as the quality of people, I think we simply don't know, simply because the PLA Navy doesn't operate. It certainly has nothing like the op tempo that we're used to in our own Navy or in allied navies. And I think we really don't know. And the Chinese have actually, I would say some of their operating practices are designed to keep us in the dark. For example, over in the Gulf of Aden, where the PLA Navy has kept the squadron on station since late 2008, the Chinese Navy it's essentially carved out its own sector and patrols that for pirates. But you always get the sense that part of this is simply because simply to keep other navies from watching them too closely. So again, I don't think we have a really clear sense of that. As you all were probably in the Navy back in the Cold War. In fact, you were in the Navy back in the Cold War. You remember that the Soviet ships looked rather impressive from a distance, but if you got up too close, they were kind of dirty and ill maintained and clearly lacking on that side. Admiral Cunningham, the Royal Navy admiral back during the Second World War, famously said, "You can build a ship in 3 days, or excuse me, you can build a ship in 3 years, but it takes 300 years to build a naval tradition." So I think China is just at the beginning of that evolution.
Right, and I think, though, however, that we do need to give the Chinese some credit in terms of the recognition of this problem. They do recognize that software is going to be an incredibly important enabler in terms of their sea power, and that's why they are increasingly focusing on training and education and increasing the realism in their exercises and so on and so forth to enhance that software piece of the puzzle. And I think that they're also looking back at history. I've read a couple of interesting studies about the lessons learned that they got from the Sino-Japanese War of 1895, when the Chinese were really defeated by the Japanese in a very humiliating way. And one of the key lessons they drew from that is the lack of human capital, lack of investment in human capital in manning the ships that were arguably better in some ways than the Japanese ships, and yet they were still defeated. And they've been talking about that particular war for at least a decade now, really examining that human dimension of warfare. So, yes, you know, this is the one issue that we know least about, and it's also one that might be their critical vulnerability, but I think we should give them some credit for recognizing that problem and taking active efforts to rectify it.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting when Toshi mentioned the Sino-Japanese War. It seems rather politically incorrect, but many of these analysts will look back at the defeat of the Chinese Beiyang Fleet in 1894 and 1895 and say, and they will actually praise the Imperial Japanese Navy for the not only for the material quality of the fleet, but also the martial spirit displayed by the Japanese seamen at that conflict.
When we were talking about Russia, you brought up a topic that's kind of one of my little hobby horses I like to jump on now and then, and that was demographics. And you're talking about, you know, the Russian demographic situation is a horror show when you look at it. But there's also, when you talk about China and where China's going future and future capabilities, usually by the end of the conversation, there's some grumpy old economist in the corner who will raise his little finger and say, you may want to consider the following. And kind of the argument that they will make is before China gets rich, they're going to get old because of the second and third order effects of their one-child policy. And that one thing that we're going to see in the next 20, 30 years is instead of being outwardly focused like a growing Royal Navy or a growing Japan or a growing Germany or a growing America did, that China instead will have to turn internally because they're going to have this aging population that they're going to have to try to keep hold of, combined with this rising generation that has been, for lack of a better phrase, spoiled. Many of them have been educated in the West. And so they're going to go back to that traditional Chinese case of just trying to keep their own people under control. Do you see that trend developing, and how might that impact any future naval development that the Chinese will be making?
Let me take a stab at that, and then I'll turn it over to you.
As it happens,
we're both contributing to a volume edited by Toshi's wife, who's also an international relations PhD, about demographics and in national security. I'll let Toshi take on the specifics, but I offered an introductory chapter on comparing the impact of demographics on Athens and Sparta back to Thucydides again. You found that both sides suffered severe demographic blows during that conflict, and in the Spartan case even before that. But demographic decline seemed to have opposite impact on each society. The Spartans acted very cautiously, as you might expect, and this seems to be the template or the dominant view of how demographics affects strategy. Declining demographics hurts strategy. But the Athenians, if you look at their side, they suffered a plague in the opening years of that conflict and lost a third of the population. Yet in the wake of the plague, the Athenian population or the Athenian society simply went nuts and started flailing around wildly in different expeditions. Ultimately, the invasion of Sicily, which was a real disaster. So the overall, I think it's perhaps a little too pat to say that declining demographics is going to make a society more cautious. It probably tends to do that, but it's no guarantee.
Right. I know that time is short, so let me just very quickly talk about this. As it relates to China itself, I think that there are sort of two schools of thought about China and its population. One is that I think the argument that you've made, which is that a geriatric society, an older society that cares more about social welfare, et cetera, is likely to have a more inward-looking and much more conservative outlook on foreign policy. There's also an additional element to that, which is the one-child policy. A one-child policy, I think, could in fact result in parents who are much less likely to allow their children to serve in the military. And I think that too might create a much more conservative, risk-averse society when the parents only have one child in the family and they're pampered and they're the jewel in the family. On the other hand, if you think about it in terms of broader strategic trends, the Chinese are very aware that there's going to be a crossover point where India will in fact take over the Chinese in terms of being the largest population in the world. And I think this sort of, and it's one of their sort of tools in their toolbox in terms of statecraft. When they talk about China's future, it's always about China being one of the largest, being the largest countries in the world. And I think this notion that China will, in fact, be second place to India and so on and so forth might, in fact, create this potential for closing windows of opportunity, that as China gets older, it might be less willing and able to resolve some of their problems abroad, and so that they might feel that time is not on their side and that they need to act sooner rather than later in resolving this international dispute. So I think that debate is still ongoing. It's not resolved, but I think the picture is not as clear as whether it's a very pessimistic forecast or a very optimistic forecast.
Yeah, the other...
Well,
let
me follow up on that for a second, because part of China's one-child thing is the infanticide of the young females. They want male children, so they're going to have an imbalance there. How are they going to look at that down the road?
30
right,
seconds.
And I think that's the other school of thought too, is that the one-child policy and then the bias towards males is going to create a huge male-female racial imbalance, and that some would argue that countries that tend to have many more males and females in terms of the ratio in the population are likely to create a much more aggressive and martial-looking society because they want to sort of export some of those problems abroad by looking at, you know, violence, cross-border violence, in other words, by, you know, becoming a much more aggressive-looking society. You know, that school of thought is out there as well.
And for the listeners, if you like what you heard, please pick up Jim and Toshi's book, Red Star Over the Pacific, China's Rise and the Challenge to U.S. Maritime Security. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time out this Sunday. Good luck with the book, and say hi to everybody up at the Naval War College for me.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the invitation. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
It's a long way to Tipperary.